Two of the books that have appeared on him are complete biographies, which show what I spoke about last time, the complexity of the man and how he rose from very humble beginnings to become not just the world's most important rabbi, but one of the leading power brokers in Israeli politics. Incidentally, let me just point out that since today we live in an era, I don't know what it's like in Mexico, but in America, we have rabbis saying all sorts of things, even like, I don't know if you know what Starbucks is, but that you can't even go into a Starbucks without hashkafa on the store. You know, it's refreshing to read how Rav Avadia and his students would spend time at the coffee houses of Cairo, where it might have been that Chacham Avadia picked up his love of Arabic music, Egyptian music. Now, anyone who reads the various works written on the life of Rav Avadia is confronted with a paradox, I think, because on the one hand, his knowledge was unmatched. If you have ever studied his writings, you see that his knowledge was simply incomprehensible how much he knew. None of the other rabbinic authorities come close to him in this regard. In fact, I would go further and say that it's impossible really to take seriously a so-called chief rabbinate where he was not holding the top position. And as mentioned already, he came from a very humble beginning. He did not have the yichus, you know, the lineage, which is so much a part of the rabbinic world. Furthermore, throughout his career, he showed great courage and compassion, be it during his time in Egypt, as we saw last class, when he battled against communal leaders who had no concern for halakha, or when he spent sleepless nights going over army files till not one aguna remained from the Yom Kippur War. It's no surprise that he earned the respect and admiration of hundreds of thousands, observant and non-observant alike. As I mentioned, his funeral was 700,000 estimated. Non-religious, or what we would call non-Orthodox Jews, were there too, traditional Jews. Those who knew Rav Avadia, who were close to him, knew that he was a loyal and honorable man who was prepared to suffer the attacks of others in the name of truth as he saw it. Yet there is a paradox here, because the same man who spent most of his day at the most advanced level of Torah study, in the years following his entry into politics, and only then, also showed a side more reflective of what we can call the low culture of his youth. Now, there is, to be sure, a positive side to us. No scholar in the Sephardic world was able to form an attachment with the masses like Rav Avadia. If anyone attended his Saturday night lectures, going back a ways, I was able to go in 1985 when I lived in Israel, yeshiva that year. Anyone who was there can attest that his, and you can watch them now on videos, his mix of Torah, stories, and humor had great appeal for the man on the streets. And this is a quality he had as a young yeshiva student, where it became apparent very quickly that in addition to his great knowledge, he had a gift for speaking to the less educated. Yet, together with this, Rav Avadia was also known for numerous shocking statements, as well as for cursing out this or that politician, including religious politicians. Not surprisingly, the secular newspapers monitored his talks. They would send reporters to every one of his talks. And in the last 10 years of his life, they could watch it on the internet, waiting for the next juicy quote. I don't think Rav Avadia ever completely understood that when you're with a small group, that it's one thing to speak to a small group and you can use banter and speak to them what we call off the cuff. But when your comments are going to be broadcast on first by newspapers and then later by the internet to the entire world, you really need to speak in a different fashion. People will not understand what you're saying and it could be offensive to them. After a while, people got used to the fact that the man who soared the heights of Torah scholarship was able to come up with all sorts of shocking statements. And it's a paradox, because the same man who brought Shas into a labor merits government, an action which brought down upon him the wrath of much of the Orthodox world, was also the one who called Yossi Sarid Haman and Satan, stating, God will uproot him like he uproots Amalek. The same man who said that land can be given back to the Arabs for peace and who had a good relationship with Hosni Mubarak, president of Egypt, also referred to the Arabs as snakes. So already we see we're dealing with a complicated individual. What I can say is that I hope that in the future, people will forget about these comments, which anyone can make comments like this. These were l'sha, as we would say, for the time, not l'doro. I think we're going to have to split, you know, some of these negative comments he made, shocking things he said. Those will not endure. Those will be forgotten. What will endure, of course, will be his great Torah knowledge and his halachic writings. The biographies, though, they cover all of this. They also speak about the difficult relationships he had with other rabbis, including with his own son, Rabbi Yaakov, who predeceased him, and from whom he was largely estranged at times. Books that have been published on Chacham Avadia, published in his lifetime, also contain extracts from his diaries. And in those, you can find all sorts of negative comments about his early opponents, including his predecessor as chief rabbi, Rav Nissim, about the famed Mekubal, Rav Kaduri, who would later become an important part of the Shas political machine. Neither of these books that I'm referring to explain how they came to these passages from Chacham Avadia's diaries. The only thing we can conclude is that Rav Avadia gave them this information. He cooperated with his biographers. We'll see why in a few minutes. Since Rav Avadia often took positions, I just mentioned going into the labor government, labor merits, giving back land. Since he often took positions not in accord with the leadership of the Ashkenazi Haredi world, it's not surprising that he was often a focus of their anger. Not to mention the fact that the Shas party was taking votes away from the Ashkenazic parties when he was allied with them, when he took orders from the Ashkenazim, as it were. If you looked in the Ashkenazi papers, they gave him all the big titles, all the high titles that are so important. When he parts with them, then all of a sudden it becomes permissible for them to attack him in all sorts of ways. By the way, it wasn't only his political outlook that brought down the wrath of the Ashkenazi Haredim. I mentioned earlier that after the Yom Kippur War, he worked tirelessly to free all the Agunot. This is an important element. You can see in Yabia Omer, his volume of Teshuvot, his lengthy Teshuvah dealing with this. His reputation as an outstanding posek was solidified by this. Any posek who deals with Agunot has to read his lengthy Teshuvah. Yet I found in an Ashkenazi Haredi work discussing this episode, Rav Avadia is actually referred to as Ovadia, without even putting a resh before his name. He is also derided as one who, quote, will rely on a teshuvah, even if it's from a book not accepted, such as from some author from Egypt or something similar. I would merely say that for the Ashkenazi Haredim, no author from Egypt in the last few hundred years would qualify as accepted, as their perspective is entirely Ashkenazic-centered. Standard works in the Sephardi halachic tradition, these are works such as Erech HaShulchan, Petach HaDevir, Yafel Lalev, and the numerous writings of Rav Chaim Palachi, as well as many other Sephardic figures, are simply not regarded as having significance by the typical Ashkenazi posek. They're not in their canon. Although the dispute over the Agunot was an example of halachic disagreements between Rav Avadia and the Ashkenazi Haredim, the fact is that had he never adopted a different political stand, they never would have disrespected him. And when I used to read the Haredi attacks on Rav Avadia, I have to confess they reminded me of like a flea attacking an elephant. Rav Avadia, he was so big that this is meaningless to him. He was the one who had the power and influence, and Shas was much more important as a political party than the Ashkenazi parties, and also had the purse strings to distribute money. Quite a success story, considering that in 1992, Rav Shach famously declared that Sephardim were not yet capable of leading, that they had to follow the Ashkenazi. This comment, coming on top of decades of discrimination against Sephardim in the Ashkenazic school system, which continues to this day, by the way, was this comment of Rav Shach was the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of Shas breaking off on its own. The Shas party was founded by Sephardim, who were looked to Rav Shach as their guide. And then when Rav Avadia was brought in, Rav Avadia was allied with Rav Shach. But over time, Rav Avadia becomes the leader of the party. And after this comment of Rav Shach, There was a strong feeling of ethnic identification with Shas by Sfardim of all levels of religious commitment. Rav Shach's picture was ripped up in development towns as people declared that they never again would vote for Ashkenazim. Shas plastered Rav Shach's patronizing words on walls throughout Israel. Loudspeakers went through cities, towns, Sephardic areas, playing the tape of what Rav Shach said again and again. I guess you could say stoking the fires of anti-Ashkenazic sentiment. Now look, the contempt with which the Ashkenazi Haredim have treated the Sephardim is well known, that I don't need to deal with it here. And as I mentioned, there's still discrimination that continues. But I also have to note that Rav Shach's comment was not as bad as it appeared. What Rav Shach meant, well, first of all, Rav Shach actually stood out in declaring forthrightly that there must be no discrimination in the yeshivot, that they have to take Sfardim, whereas many of the Ashkenazi schools felt it was okay to discriminate against Sfardim, and the Sfardim they would take would be the ones who had the Hebrew expression is hishtachnez. You know, you might be Moroccan, but no one would ever know it because you act Ashkenazi. Rav Shach was strongly against this, and his words did not have as much impact as they should have. However, when Rav Shach said that the Sfardim are not ready to lead, what he meant was that due to their historical experiences, they did not know how to deal with the anti-Torah forces. It was with reference to that that he said the Sfardim are not yet ready to lead. So, for example, for Rav Avadia, it seems, and for many in the Sephardic world, their attitude was, what's the difference between Rabin or Perez versus Shamir? They're both Mechallel Shabbat. They're both not religious. What's the difference? We can be with either of them in a government. And Rav Shach's point is that no, we Ashkenazi, who have lived with these people already back in Europe, we know that although they might both be Mechallel Shabbat, you know, the Likud are more traditional, you know, they have a more respectful attitude towards religion than the leftist parties, even though they're both Mechallel Shabbat. And some actually thought that Rav Shach showed prophetic insight, because shortly following his statement, his controversial statement, Rav Avadia agreed to have Shas join a government in which Shulamit Aloni was Minister of Education. I don't know if you remember Shulamit Aloni, but she was a very strong anti-religious personality. Well, in truth, the break between the Shas and the Ashkenazi was inevitable. Sephardic society was ready for a political party that would encompass the whole community. That is, those who are what we call Orthodox and those who just have a strong attachment to tradition. Look, how long could you expect Sfardim to be led by Ashkenazim, who at their Torah gatherings, the Negudat Israel, would conduct them in Yiddish? Talk about letting the Sephardic rabbis who they would invite to the Agudat Yisrael meetings, talk about letting them feel unwanted when you conduct your meetings in a language they can understand. So here we come to Rav Avadia's real significance. It is Rav Avadia Yosef who single-handedly restored the pride to Sephardic Jewry. The slogan of Shas, the Hachazir Atara Yoshna, to restore the pride, to restore the crown to its glory, that says it all. Rav Avadia ushered in a new era in which Sephardim do not need to be regarded or regard themselves as second-class citizens in the Torah world. This is a great achievement, and it's the reason why so many Orthodox, so many Sephardim who are not completely halachic voted for Shas and continue to vote for Shas. I mean, we all know, you know better than me, that the Sephardic world has a range of levels of observance. Even those who are not what we would call completely halachic have great respect for tradition and religious leaders. They'll kiss the hands of the rabbis. You know, to when you're in Jerusalem, you'll be in a falafel stand, and the person is clearly not religious the way we think of religious, but he has pictures of Rabbanim on the wall, the way that Ashkenazi people will not have. The Sephardic Jews are not chilonim. The ones who are not completely observant are masoratiim. They have great respect for tradition. Shas was able to tap into these feelings, convince many of these people to send their children to their schools. And that created a huge growth, really an explosion of Sephardic students whose parents were traditional, but who became completely halachic after going through the Shas schools. So from this perspective, there's nothing surprising about the wide-ranging Sephardic support for Shas. But what makes Rav Avadya's political achievement even more significant is that until the Gaza withdrawal, he and the Shas party were identified with dovish political positions. That is, his support for giving back land if you could find a real peace. He also had a very good relationship with Shimon Peres. The views of the typical Sephardic voter are much more in line with the right-wing parties, much more in line with Likud. They come from the Arab world. They know what it was like there, and they do not want to give back land. And nevertheless, they, despite that, so many of them were willing to vote for a political party that believed in giving back land. It shows, it's a testament to his great strength, Chacham Avadya, that he was able to bring these voters to support him, even though politically they had a different perspective. And it's also a testament to his strength of character. He didn't alter his opinion. Had Chacham Avad Yosef adopted a more hawkish opinion and said, we do not support giving back land, he would have had even more Sephardic voters voting for him. But he would not compromise his basic principles. Now, it's true that at the end of his life, his assessment of the possibility of peace soured, and he didn't think that there was possible to give back land. But that's because he didn't think there was a partner. However, the principle, the yesod, that you can give back land in Eretz Israel if it'll bring real peace, remained firm in his mind. By the way, you shouldn't just think that it's Shas only for political reasons spoke about the Ashkenazi-Sephardic divide. Rav Avadya himself made a number of statements critical of Ashkenazi society, and they are not only intended for the masses. They reflect more serious concern. For example, if you look in volume introductions to his great Teshuvot, Yabia Omer, volumes 1 and 3, he expresses disagreement. He disputes the Ashkenazi Haredi yeshiva world's approach to Torah study. What do they do in the Ashkenazi yeshivot? They focus on theoretical analysis. Chacham Avadya says, no, you need to focus on halacha lemaaseh. That's our approach. Focus on halacha. You study the Talmud to bring it into the halacha. In the Ashkenazi yeshivot, it's all theoretical. One of Chacham Avadya's first acts when he becomes chief rabbi of Tel Aviv in 1969, he permits Sfaradim to marry from the 17th of Tammuz to the 1st of Av. This is against the Ashkenazic practice. The Ashkenazic practice is from 17th of Tammuz until Tisha B'Av, there are no weddings. But that's not the Sephardic approach. And Chacham Avadya said that the previous rabbis in Tel Aviv, they felt they didn't want to challenge the Ashkenazi rabbis in this area. But he had no such hesitation. He also, there was a takana signed by the first Sephardic chief rabbi of Eretz Israel, of Israel, Rav Uziel, banning Yibum, Levirate marriage, in favor of Chalitza. Rav Uziel thought we need to have one halachic standard. Rav Avadya saw this as a betrayal of the Sephardic tradition. According to Chacham Avadya, you can do Yibum, Levirate marriage. You don't need to do Chalitza. Sephardim always did Yibum. So he got rid of that when he became chief rabbi. When he was Rav of Tel Aviv, he changed the language of the kashrut certification. Until his time for Pesach, packages would say something like this: not kosher for Pesach, except for those who eat kitniot. He changed it: kosher for Pesach, except for those who don't eat kitniot. In other words, you're in the land of Israel. This is the land of the Shulchan Aruch. Kitniot are permissible. If the Ashkenazim don't want to eat kitniot, fine. But don't say not kosher for Pesach unless you eat kitniot. Change it. Say kosher for Pesach unless you don't eat kitniot. Although Chacham Avadya always shows respect for the Ashkenazi scholars, even when he's rejecting his opinion, that's when he's writing. However, when speaking to his followers, there were plenty of times where he downplayed the significance of Ashkenazi scholars. Even the Chazon Ish, who's regarded as the most important 20th century Ashkenazi Haredi figure, Chacham Ovadia didn't have this feeling of awe for the Ashkenazi rabbis that Ashkenazim had. In fact, he even went so far as to say that the Chazon Ish is not a Moreh Hora'ah, that is, he's not regarded as a posek, because he didn't have communal responsibilities. He just wrote his books, and Chacham Avadia says he loved to be stringent, adding chumrot on chumrot. Chacham Avadia said that only a rabbi who was rav of a community, who sees how his rulings affect people, should be regarded as a posek. Needless to say, this created enormous controversy from the Ashkenazic side, because the Chazon Ish, you know who you're talking about here. In terms of his long-term significance, there is no question that Chacham Ovadia Yosef was the most important Sephardic figure since Rav Yosef Cairo, Maran. And you can truly state Mi Yosef, from Yosef Cairo, to Yosef, to Ovadia Yosef, none arose like Yosef. Look, we have many rabbis who are great in their times. Think about Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. But Rav Ovadia was not simply great in his generation. He accomplished a very rare feat. He changed the course of Torah history in both a sociological and religious sense. This is the sort of thing that only happens a few times in a millennium. I mean, the typical thing is that after great rabbis pass away, their influence begins to wane. They're not so remembered so much. It's very rare that your influence remains. And that's what we see with Rav Ovadia. And I will explain to you how he permanently altered the halachic tradition of Sephardic Jewry. By the way, Chacham Ovadia had a tendency, very well known, to be lenient, mekel. And in the months leading up to his election as chief rabbi, he publicly stated this approach. He said that we Sephardim, we're like Beit Hillel. The Ashkenazi rabbis are like Beit Shammai. They're always trying to find chumrot and make life difficult. Now, there are exceptions to this lenient tendency. For example, his consistent ruling that shadels are forbidden. That's one of his stringencies. He refused to back down on that and said, shadels are absolutely forbidden. But his tendency is almost always in the other direction. If you look at his teshuvot dealing with family matters, marriage, divorce, agunot, you see that he almost always can come to a lenient decision, and he's aware of his responsibilities. There's no question that the final address for the most complicated questions when it came to halacha was Rav Ovadia. And even in his final years, when he had, you could say, Haredi tendencies, it seemed, when push came to shove, it showed that he had a Klal Yisrael mentality, sensibility. So, for instance, he never backed away from the Heter Mechira, the sale of the land during the sabbatical year. The Ashkenazic rabbis refused to go along with this. And in fact, the last time when he was alive, they sold the land in his house. Chacham Ovadia said, you want to be strict on Shemitah? Be strict. But not everyone can be strict. And we have to have a halacha for the entire people. He gave his imprimatur to the conversions performed in the army, which were attacked by the Ashkenazi Haredim. If you read his teshuvot, there are multiple levels. He tells you the basic halacha. And then he'll say, Hamachmir tavo ala bracha. You want to be stringent? Be stringent, but that's not the basic halacha, and you can't force people. He wasn't like the Ashkenazi Haredi, Ashkenazi Gedolim. Many Ashkenazi Gedolim, they grow up in society, and they live their entire life without having any connection to the non-religious. I mean, literally never speak to them, except maybe if they get in the bus, and no connection. They don't know what it's like outside their religious society. You can see, for instance, Chacham Ovadia on YouTube when he has a meeting with the Israeli soccer team. These people, they're so ignorant, these soccer players, they come to the Gadol Hador, they're wearing t-shirts and jeans, they don't even know how to dress. But Chacham Ovadia speaks to them, and each one comes up to them, he gives them his trademark little patch on the face. That's what you find with Chacham Ovadia, a man of the people. He really cared about the immigrants, the poor people, the immigrants from Ethiopia, or the poor people in development towns. It was a Klal Yisrael mentality. I want to tell you a story, which I heard. When one of the books I mentioned was published, biographies, there was a book launch. And one of the rabbis there told Rosh Yeshiva from one of the Hezri Yeshivas told this story, which he heard from his student, who was a chaplain at the hospital. And this, I think, says it all. I mean, I can give you many other examples. You know, Shalit, Gilad Shalit's father. He's an Ashkenazi, but I'm pretty sure he's an Ashkenazi. But I mean, where did he go to? Who supported him? Chacham Avadi Yosef. Hold on a second here. Well, this is going on permanent, so I just don't want to say something that isn't true. Yes, he must be. I can't see anything here online quickly. Let me just look quickly here, but I don't see anything that would lead me to think that, I'll just say quickly, I mean, everything I could see looks very much like an Ashkenazi. Anyone could tell me otherwise. He learned in just looking at his whole family. So, but that's okay. Let's go back to what I want to tell you. So I want to tell you an amazing story. This man, this chaplain, this student of this Rosh Yeshiva was in a hospital and, you know, in the maternity ward. And of course, what do you have in a maternity ward? You have mothers and fathers and their babies. And he sees a woman there with a baby, no husband, and no parents. So, you know, he's curious, he asks. So he says, he speaks to this woman and, you know, what's going on? Why no family? And she says she can't tell her father. First, the father of the baby, he's out of the picture. So what about her family? She said, she's told the story that although they grew up irreligious, I guess Moroccan family, if I recall correctly, in her later years, after she had already finished high school, her father became more religious. Rav Avadia would give a shiur every week on the radio, and her father would always listen. So her father became more religious. So now she grew up like irreligious when the father was irreligious. Now the parents are religious. She's still not. She says she can't tell her parents. Her father would never accept that she had a child out of wedlock. And so when this chaplain told his Rosh Yeshiva, the Rosh Yeshiva contacted Chacham Avadi Yosef. And what happened is as follows. Shortly after that, this man, the father of the girl who had the baby, gets a phone call and Chacham Avadia's office that they want to speak to him. And, you know, this is like in America, we'd say the president calls you and it's a big deal. And this man is invited to meet with Chacham Avadia. No idea why, out of the blue, he gets a phone call to meet with Chacham Avadia. But of course, this is the biggest day of his life. And he goes there. And the Rosh Yeshiva was also there at this meeting, the one who told the story. He comes in and Chacham Avadia is there, is set up in front. He has some cake and something to drink. And he says to the man as follows, I want you to know that your daughter gave birth to a son. They just came out of the hospital, whatever he said. Now it's, we're going to make a l'chaim here. I'm wishing you a mazel tov. And your responsibility now is to go home and help raise this child to Torah, to Masim Tovim, the rest of it. And so, I mean, this is like an unbelievable story of how you can't imagine it with other great rabbis. And it shows his connection to just the man on the street, the simple person. This child born out of wedlock from this girl, you know, totally irreligious, but that, you know, the grandfather can, it's a Jewish neshama to help raise the child. In terms of Chacham Avadia's lenient tendency, let me speak about other halachic matters. You see this again and again. Take gelatin. I don't know what you do in Mexico, but in America, we generally follow the kashrut organizations. They do not accept gelatin. They assume it's not kasher. That's the OU, the OK, all the big organizations. Chacham Avadia held that all gelatin is kosher. Dishwasher, one dishwasher is all you need for meat and dairy. This is makes perfect sense on halachic grounds. But in America, it's not the minhag. But as with all such minhagim, it could change. But in the Sephardic world, it might be totally different. But Rav Avadia, if this is what the halacha says in his mind, he doesn't need to say, let's be stringent. You want to be stringent, you can be stringent, but we're going to force everyone to buy a second dishwasher. Another great leniency. which would be unthinkable in this country, is his ruling that a restaurant that serves, I mentioned this last week, or when we met for Pesach, that serves milk products immediately after meat, or even together if they're both cold, must be given a hashgacha if it's requested. He calls this a chova kedosha, an obligation, because these people who are coming to this place, if we don't give a hashgacha, then they're not going to eat kosher food. So better to give a hashgacha, and if they eat milk and meat, how is that any different than going to the supermarket and buying it? Rabbi Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer, is outraged by this. He doesn't understand. How can you give a hashgacha if they're serving milk and meat cold, even if it's cold? But I mentioned a few weeks ago, I don't know if it's still the case, that this sports club in Mexico City, Rav Moshe Feinstein agreed with this very same heter. Because if you don't do this, granted, it's not the highest level. You shouldn't have milk and meat in the same place. But if that's the best you can do, and you're not dealing with the most religious people, obviously, that's what you should do to prevent them from eating non-kosher.
You know, sorry to interrupt. You know his position on Bishul, like Bishul Goy for the...
I'm getting to that. We're coming to that. 2 minutes. You're like okay. A Navi. Operating in an environment removed from conservative Judaism, which in the Sephardic world you don't have, he was able to look at the halacha without worrying, you know, where it's going to lead to. If you look at the Ashkenazi poskim, take bat mitzvah, which is now accepted, but for years it wasn't, because the attitude was, this was started by the conservatives and we can't go along with them. No, for Chacham Avadia, if the Ben Ish Chai mentions bat mitzvah, then it's good enough for us. His vision was clear. In Eretz Yisrael, a Torah society that the Sephardic rabbis lead. Rav Yosef Karo, author of the Shulchan Aruch, that is what halacha follows. In fact, in some places in his writings, you get the impression that he thinks even Ashkenazim should have to follow Maran Yosef Karo when they go to Eretz Yisrael. In other places in his writings, he says no. He says only Sephardim. But it's unclear, because sometimes it seems to be saying that really, when we're one day, even the Ashkenazi will follow this. And he does say that an Ashkenazi can become a Sephardi. He has to take everything, the good and the bad, not just kidney out to eat. But he says that you can become a Sephardi. Yet even with the Sephardim, Rav Avadia's position, which he held from his youth, was controversial. I mentioned this already when we first met. Even as a young man, he insisted that we must, in the land of Israel, follow the Shulchan Aruch, even when it diverges from the Ben Ish Chai. Huge controversy. And you got to the point where some people, even it's reported, burnt one of his Sfarim because they thought he was disrespectful to the Ben Ish Chai. We're talking about in the 1950s. They disrupted his Shiurim. And I have to say that Chacham Avadia's position is a radical position, I think. Because before him, no one actually said that everyone in Israel has to follow every position of the Shulchan Aruch. If you come from another place as a community, the tradition was you can continue with your own minhagi, but he said not. Now, there are some times that Chacham Avadia decides against the Shulchan Aruch. They're very rare, but there are a few, and that gets to the question we just heard. So for instance, according to the Shulchan Aruch, a Sephardi, and Sephardim hold of this, Ashkenazim do not, that meat, that food has to be cooked, not just like the Ashkenazim, just lighting the stove, but the entire food process has to be done by the Jew. Well, what would that mean, therefore? Does that mean that a Sephardi can't go to a restaurant? Let's say you live in New York. I don't know the situation in Mexico, but New York, every single restaurant, without exception, follows the Rav Moshe Isserles. That is, that the Ashkenazi light the flame, and the non-Jew cooks the whole meal. Every bar mitzvah, every wedding. So does that mean that Sephardim cannot participate, cannot partake? Chacham Avadia says no. He says they can. They can eat at restaurants. They can eat at catering halls. He uses a safek sveka, a double doubt, it's called. Maybe, what are the two doubts that allow, in halacha, often if you have a double doubt on a rabbinic prohibition, if you have a double doubt on a rabbinic prohibition, it's permissible. What's the two safekot? One, maybe it is okay if the Jew only lights the flame. Like maybe Rav Moshe Isserles is correct. Safek one, against the Shulchan Aruch. Safek two, maybe the law of Bishul Akum does not apply to someone who's hired, a worker. The Shulchan Aruch rejects both of these points. And yet Chacham Ovadia nevertheless applies both of them to a Safek Sfeika to reject the Shulchan Aruch. Now it's obvious that what's pushing Rav Ovadia here is his Kal Yisrael perspective. It's unimaginable for him that you could have a situation where Sfaradim couldn't come to a wedding of Ashkenazi or a bar mitzvah or go to a restaurant or things like that. So he's able to rely on a Safek Sfeika. What about an Ashkenazi coming to a Sfaradi coming to an Ashkenazi's house? We don't eat chalak meat. Chacham Ovadia said that Sfaradim have to eat chalak, Beit Yosef meat. Now, I'm sure that in Mexico City today, all the meat is Beit Yosef chalak. But I also tell you that this is also a revolution of Chacham Ovadia. You can ask your grandparents. 50 years ago, there was no such thing as chalak meat in Mexico. There was no such thing as chalak meat in New York. There was the only place that was chalak meat was in Israel, in Jerusalem, and places like that, and in Gerba. Not even in Tunis, not in Morocco, nowhere. This is basically a revolution of Chacham. Maybe in Iraq they had it, but they. So that shows you his significance. But so what does this mean then? That Ashkenazim, that Sfaradim cannot eat at Ashkenazim? I invite the Sfaradi to my house for Shabbat meal. He can't come. Well, if you look at this halacha, Shulchan Aruch, no, he cannot come because I don't have chalak meat. Chacham Avadia says no, he can go eat there. He also applies a Sfek Sfeika, and there's no question that he's being guided here by a Kal Yisrael mentality, because this is a Sfek Sfeika, again, at odds with the Shulchan Aruch. What's a Sfek Sfeika? Suffix number one, maybe the halakha is like the Ashkenazic approach, the Ramah, that you don't need halak Beit Yosef meat, number one, and maybe this particular animal that you're eating was actually halak. You know, so there's two sfeikot. So, yes, for Sfaradim, he says, at their own house, they have to buy chalak meat. But when they go out, either at a restaurant or invited to someone's house, and that explains why all of you guys, all the Sfaradim, you go to Israel, you say you can't eat at the restaurant, you can't go to the Waldorf Hotel or the King David or Inba, wherever you go to and eat at the dining rooms. Of course you can. Because Chacham Ovadia, you'll say, well, of course you can if you follow Chacham Ovadia, but I don't know anyone who disagrees with him, because then if not, we wouldn't be able to eat with each other. Let me give you an example of his great influence, but also the difficulties that his position created. There's an old question. Can a woman make a beracha on a mitzvah taseh shazman grama, a time-bound positive commandment, since she's not obligated? The Shulchan Aruch said, Sfirat HaOmer would also be, although it's not clear whether Sfirat HaOmer is today is Deraita or Derabanan. So, but let's take things that we know are Deraita, like a shaking lulav. Shulchan Aruch says no. Rav Moshe Isserles says yes. Despite the Shulchan Aruch's ruling, women in many Sephardic communities did make the blessing over the lulav. I don't know. I think most of you are from Syrian background, right? Aleppo. You can tell me. I don't know what the practice was in Aleppo, but I can tell you that in Iraq they made the beracha. In Morocco, many of them made beracha. In many Sephardic communities, in Tunisia made the beracha. And these were practices that predated the Shulchan Aruch. Yet Chacham Ovadia was intent on ensuring that all Sfaradim adopt the Shulchan Aruch, even outside of Eretz Yisrael. And I've been told by people that even among communities where they used to have the women make the beracha, today they stopped doing it. It shows you his great influence. I'll give you another example, even more. Lighting Shabbat candles. The Shulchan Aruch's position seems to be, it's not 100% clear, but seems to be that the... You make the beracha and then light. That's the normal way of doing things. But the Ashkenazic practice is you light and then make the beracha. And that was the practice throughout the Sephardic world, all over the Sephardic world. Most Sephardim did it that way. And think what lighting the Shabbat candles is. It's a practice that a girl learns from her mother, and it's tied with all this, you know, symbolism. You know, she grew up with her mother doing it. Chacham Ovadia challenged that. And I heard from one of the rabbis in New York, from the Aleppo community, that their practice also was to, I guess, well, maybe, I assume that would be your practice as well from Aleppo. He said their practice was to do at the Ashkenazim, light the candle and make the beracha. And because of Rav Avadia's strong influence, they changed the practice. Do you know what this is? When you have a woman, she's been laying Shabbat candles for 30, 40 years. She saw her mother and her grandmother do it, and yet she changes her practice because the rabbi tells them. There was only one rabbi in the world that could tell a woman, change the practice that you've been doing and that your mother and grandmother and great-grandmother did. Any other rabbi tried to do it, they'd say, who is this rabbi? He can't tell me what to do. It shows you the great significance of Rav Avadia. And the impact is seen, not just him as a personality. His son, Rav Yitzchak Yosef, the current Rishon LeZion, put out a modern Shulchan Aruch called Yalkut Yosef, which is now found in Beit Knesset all over the world, had enormous influence. The Shas school system, where the children, all these thousands of children went to, and they were taught in accordance with Chacham Avadia Yosef's ruling, this has been very successful in uprooting many local practices and creating a unified Sephardic Land of Israel practice. Did everyone fall into line? No. And it could be that there will be, they will not be entirely successful because the Moroccans are the largest group in Israel. And although many Moroccans did fall into line, many Moroccans refused to accept Chacham Avadia Yosef's idea that you have to change your minhagim. So it remains to be seen going forward whether there'll be a pushback to Chacham now that he's not with us. Is there going to be a pushback? Or the fact that Yalkut Yosef is so significant and the Shas school system is so significant, if even the holdouts will have to give in. Let me say a few more things. This is a good example of where you see how Chacham Ovadia was able to achieve almost the impossible, namely influence thousands of women, thousands of people to change well-adopted practices. And that's what I think is worth noting. I just want to say a few more things because really, I mean, we just touched the surface of Chacham Ovadia. He wasn't just a man. He was really a phenomenon. Before our eyes, we saw the creation of a halachic tradition that permanently altered the direction of Torah Jewry, the Sephardic Torah Jewry, and quite unique. The one other area I want to mention is his great learning, because although I'm a great fan of it and I have so many of his writings, the Ashkenazi Haredi world was never really taken in by his learning, never really was mavatal themselves, to use the expression. Why not? Why, when you look at he knows everything, why in the Ashkenazic world did they not see any reason to follow him and just not really give much regard to his approach? That's because in the Ashkenazic world, first of all, the focus is not on practical halacha, but also not on bekiyut. If you read Chacham Avadia's writings, the stress is on vast amounts of information to use that to come to decisions. In the Ashkenazic world, that's not what the focus has been on. The focus is on original new Talmudic insights. If Chacham Avadia would say to an Ashkenazi posek that, you know, there here's 20 authorities who disagree with you, the Ashkenazi posek's attitude is, so what? You can show me 20, you can show me 100. If I think my approach is correct and I can argue that point, then that's enough. And it's just a different type of approach. Chacham Ovadia's approach is not about original chidushim creations, going back to the Talmud and Rishonim. It's about building on previous authorities, making what we call diukim, and setting forth a halachic approach based on the Talmud and the Rishonim and the Achronim. There are no chidushim in the classic Lithuanian sense. But it's just a different approach. The approach of Chacham Ovadia is the same approach you find in Rav Chaim Palachi. It's the same approach you find in a whole host of great halacha authorities. And I challenge anyone to read Chacham Ovadia Yosef's writings, even pick up one or two teshuvot, and ask yourself, how could one man have such knowledge in his head? This is before computers, before all of our Otsar HaChma and all these things that help us. So I see I've spoken already 50 minutes. Because we were cut off for the first minute, let me just repeat, for people coming on to listen to watch us later, I began by saying that his funeral, the largest funeral in probably in Jewish history, at least recorded Jewish history, and 20%, if it's 700,000 people, and they were basically all men, it seems, and this will come to almost 20,000% of the Jewish male population of the state of Israel, as I calculate it, and thousands of Sephardic yeshiva students, all due to Chacham Avad Yosef, because he didn't have Sephardic yeshivot other than one or two before he comes on the scene, that this really shows us that we're dealing with a very unusual person, one whose significance cannot be overstated. So let me end here. If any, there are any questions, I'm happy to take them. I hope this gave some insight from a more, you know, like a broad, more perspective of what made him so significant. Obviously, we could go into various teshuvot of his. He had so many rulings. I wouldn't say original rulings because he's not an Ashkenazi posek. He's using the earlier sources. But what he's done is he's has so many rulings at odds with what is the accepted approach, the standard approach, because what becomes the standard approach if Chacham Avadia says, well, wait a second, we have a whole tradition here. The Sephardic world decides halacha, was deciding halacha very differently. So on conversions, for instance, a more liberal approach. I mentioned gelatin. Why should gelatin be forbidden? Rav Chaim Palachi already speaks about you take these insects, you know, they would get the colors, carmine it's called, if you crush it. So it's no longer edible. You can use the coloring from it because it's no longer edible. So you're going to tell me that, well, in the Ashkenazic world, Rav Chaim Ozer already and other rabbis dealt with gelatin. Rav Chaim Ozer actually was lenient, but other rabbis dealt with gelatin. There's a minhag. Chacham Avadia says, what minhag? That's not our minhag. We have our own authorities. So Rav Avadia was very good in showing how what we think is the halacha, because what we've been accustomed to think, you can show, he would show from the sources that many great authorities had a completely different approach. And since we know who these authorities are and how significant they are, Chacham Avadia is able to say, we can rely on them. So what people think are great kulot, leniencies, are not really leniencies. From Chacham Avadia's perspective, he is telling you what the standard halacha is. Everything else from his mind is a chumrah. I think Chacham Avadia would probably say, I am not permitting anything. I am showing you that it is permitted. That's different. Ani lo matir, he would say. I'm showing you that it's mutar. And that's why his, and when you read his teshuvot, it's hard not to walk away from that convinced that, you know, that this is what the halacha should be. Because he doesn't just give you one source, 10 sources. Sometimes he gives you hundreds of sources. So any questions, I'm happy to take them.